Thank you for joining me today. You have found the Third Space podcast, and I am your host, Bob Fabi. And today, we're going to be listening to a brief section from C.S. Lewis's The Horse and His Boy, followed by a little bit of commentary. I appreciate the Chronicles of Narnia for a number of different reasons, not the least of which is that it helps us get our heads around a little bit of what God is doing in Christ and helping us to try to understand a little bit better the picture that we have and what kind of God we have, what he's willing to do, the great lengths that he has gone to in order to have a right relationship with us and have us rightly related to one another in the world. And if you don't know, the Chronicles of Narnia are seven series books where Lewis kind of paints different pictures of Christianity and maybe even stages or ages of Christianity in which maybe there's increasing secularization, or maybe it's when creation kind of, finds its way in terms of its identity, those kinds of things. Probably most famously is the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Most people know that one. It came out from Walden Media not too long ago. as a movie. But there's a number of books that have been written in the series. It starts with The Magician's Nephew, then the famous The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Horse and His Boy, Prince Caspian, which was made into a movie, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which was again made into a movie, The Silver Chair and The Last Battle. And they're all really helpful depictions, to try to get our heads around, an allegory of Christ, that there's this figure named Aslan, who is a lion, who is clearly meant to be Jesus. And I found them to be really helpful. And I think if I had to pick my favorite book in the seven part series, I think it's called The Horse and His Boy. And it's a story about twins who are separated, and I'm not trying to be a spoiler because I would love for you to go out and read the book. But it's a discovery of identity, and it's a discovery of meaning, and that's found within a relationship with Aslan and what that looks like. And so the heroes of the story go through a variety of things in order to kind of discover those things. I'm trying to be vague, and I'm doing it quite a good job of it. So the part of the story that I want to get to and read a section of has to do with this boy named Shasta, who is on a horse and has to ride back over kind of a harrowing mountain pass. This is what his experience is like. And so I'm going to pick it up on page. It won't matter what page it is because you don't have the same book that I do. He now knew the way to Anvard, but of course he could not go there. That would only mean running into the arms of Rabadash's troopers. "What on earth am I to do?" said Shasta to himself. But he remounted his horse and continued along the road he had chosen, in the faint hope of finding some cottage where he might ask for shelter and a meal. He had thought, of course, of going back to Erebus and Bree and Wynne at the Hermitage, but he couldn't, because by now he'd not the least idea of the direction. "After all," said Shasta, "this road is bound to get somewhere." "But that all depends on what you mean by somewhere." The road kept on getting to somewhere in the sense that it got more and more trees, all dark and dripping, and to colder and colder air. And strange icy winds kept blowing the mist past him, though they never blew it away. If he'd been used to mountain country, he would have realized that this meant he was now very high up, perhaps at the top of the pass, but Shasta knew nothing about mountains. I do think, said Shasta, that I must be the most unfortunate boy that ever lived in the whole world. Everything goes right for everyone except me. Those Narnian lords and ladies got safe away from Tashban. I was left behind. Erevas and Bree and Wynn are all as snug as anything in that old hermit. Of course, I was the one who was sent on. King Loon and his people must have got safely to the castle and shut the gates long before Rabadash arrived. But I got left out. And being very tired and having nothing inside him, he felt so sorry for himself that the tears rolled down his cheeks. What put a stop to all this was a sudden fright. Shasta discovered that someone, or somebody, was walking beside him. It was pitch dark, and he could see nothing. And the thing, or person, was going so quietly that he could hardly hear any footfalls. What he could hear was breathing. His invisible companion seemed to breathe on a very large scale, and Shasta got the impression that it was a very large creature, and he had come to notice this breathing so gradually that he really had no idea how long it had been here. It was a horrible shock. It darted into his mind that he'd heard it long ago, and that there were giants in these northern countries. He bit his lip in terror, but now that he really had something to cry about, he stopped crying. The thing, unless it was a person, went on beside him so very quietly that Shasta began to hope he had only imagined it. But just as he was becoming quite sure of it, there suddenly came a deep, rich sigh out of the darkness beside him. That couldn't be imagination. Anyway, he felt the hot breath of that sigh on his left hand. If the horse had been any good, or if he'd known how to get away, how to get any good out of a horse, he would have risked everything on a breakaway and a wild gallop. But he knew he couldn't make the horse gallop. So he went on at a walking pace, and the unseen companion walked and breathed beside him. At last he could bear it no longer. "Who are you?" he said, scarcely above a whisper. "One who has waited long for you to speak," said the thing. Its voice was not loud, but very large and deep. Are you a giant?" said Shasta. "You might call me a giant," said the large voice, "but I'm not like the creatures you call giants." "I can't see you at all," said Shasta, after staring very hard. Then, for even more terrible an idea came into his head, he said, almost in a scream, You're not something dead, are you? Oh, please, please do go away. What harm have I ever done you? Oh, I am the unluckiest person in the whole world." Once more, he felt the warm breath of the thing on his hand and face. "There," it said, "that is not the breath of a ghost. Tell me your sorrows." Shasta was a little reassured by the breath, so he told how he had never known his real father or mother, and had been brought up sternly by the fishermen. And then he told the story of his escape, and how they were chased by lions and forced to swim for their lives, and all of the dangers in Tashban, and about his night among the tombs, and how the beasts howled at him out of the desert. And he told about the heat and the thirst of their journey, and how they were almost at their goal when another lion chased them and wounded Erevas. And also how very long it was since he had had anything to eat. "I do not call you unfortunate," said the large voice. "Don't you think it was bad luck to meet so many lions?" said Shasta. "There was only one lion," said the voice. "What on earth do you mean? I've just told you there were at least two the first night, and there was only one, but he was swift of foot." "How do you know?" "I was the lion." And as Shasta gaped with open mouth and said nothing, the voice continued, "I was the lion who forced you to join with Erevas. I was the cat who comforted you among the houses of the dead. I was the lion who drove the jackals from you while you slept. I was the lion who gave the horses the new strength of fear for the last mile so that you should reach King Loon in time. And I was the lion you do not remember who pushed the boat in which you lay, a child near death, so that came to the shore where a man sat, wakeful at midnight, to receive you. Then it was you who wounded Erebus? It was I. But what for? Child, said the voice, I'm telling you your story, not hers. I tell no one any story but his own. Who are you? Asked Shasta. Myself, said the voice, very deep and low so that the earth shook. And again, myself, loud and clear and gay. And then the third time, myself, whispered so softly you could hardly hear it. And yet it seemed to come from all around as if the leaves rustled with it. Shasta was no longer afraid that the voice belonged to something that would eat him, nor that it was the voice of a ghost, but a new and different sort of trembling came over him. Yet he felt glad, too. The mist was turning from black to gray and from gray to white. This must have begun to happen some time ago, but while he had been talking to the thing, he had not been noticing anything else. Now the whiteness around him became shining whiteness. His eyes began to blink. Somewhere ahead, he could hear birds singing. He knew the night was over at last. He could see the mane and the ears and the head of the horse quite easily now. A golden light fell on them from the left. He thought it was the sun. He turned and saw, pacing beside him, taller than the horse, a lion. The horse did not seem to be afraid or of it or else couldn't see it. It was from the lion that the light came. No one ever saw anything more terrible or beautiful. Luckily, Shasta had lived all his life too far south in Calarmon to have heard the tales that were whispered in Tashban about a dreadful Narnian demon that appeared in the form of the lion. And of course, he knew no one of the soldiers about stories about Aslan, the great lion, the son of the emperor beyond the sea, the high king above all kings in Narnia. But after one glance at the lion's face, he slipped out of the saddle and fell at his feet. He couldn't say anything, but then he didn't want to say anything. And he knew he needn't say anything. The high king above all kings stooped towards him. Its mane and some strange, solemn perfume that hung around the mane was all around him. It touched his forehead with his tongue. He lifted his face and their eyes met. Then instantly, the pale brightness of the mist and the fiery brightness of the lion rolled themselves together into a swirling glory and gathered themselves up and disappeared. He was alone and with the horse on a grassy hillside under a blue sky, and there were birds singing. I love that part of the story. I think it speaks about how God has worked so many times in my life, and when I give him the opportunity, how he continues to work in my life. And on one level, I could say, well, it's about our circumstances. You know, when we're feeling frustrated, or we can't see the future, when we're lacking hope, when you can't see a way, it's easy to feel like Shasta and just say, well, I'm kind of the most unfortunate person, or at least maybe not the most unfortunate, but we could say, I'm really unfortunate. Things are really bad. But then there are those who say, well, somebody's always got it worse. And you can always make those arguments. But I think there's a huge orientation shift in the story that I really value. And it's from Shasta worrying about his problems and kind of complaining and feeling sorry for himself, which if you read the story, he has a bit of a right to do. To focusing on the one who rescues you from the problems. And the way that C.S. Lewis wrote that piece was something that I appreciated so much was the description that goes into what Shasta's thinking and feeling and how he responds to the fact that the lion is right next to him. And so when Aslan invites him to talk about his troubles, he starts sharing how he was feeling and what had happened. And Aslan helps him to see how he was actually at the center of all of those things. And I find that incredibly challenging and beautiful at the same time, because I just think, man, God is doing stuff that I can't see. And I just don't agree with some of the things that happen around me. I mean, I can't imagine if this story, you have a horrible childhood or you get chased by lions. I mean, you're not really thinking about that in terms of God providing for you, but he is in those moments. And even in the moments of doubt and even in the moments of uncertainty and frustration, that God would be at work, even in the instruments of our fear. You know, Shasta's running from lions. He's afraid he's going to be eaten. He's running like crazy. He's terrified. And that actually Aslan is at work in and through that to do something that Shasta has no idea what he's trying to complete and what he's trying to accomplish. And that those things are far bigger than the momentary fear. And I can say these things, but I have a much harder time living them out. And I'm expecting that maybe you do too, that our circumstances are temporary and challenging. And we all have maybe even kind of trite things to say about them, but they're real. And that God allows them, and in some cases even dictates them, so that something different, something more beautiful, something more redemptive, something more like him happens than even what we would want to have happen. And it's always a question of whether we can trust and whether we can believe that he's actually doing that thing. And if I were going to be truthful, I would say, man, I could use a visit from the lion, you know, kind of reminding me about who I am and who he is and the role that he plays in my life. And I can avail myself of that when I choose to. Too often I choose not to, and I operate in fear. But that reminder that he is always with us is true. But it's the reminder is always there for us. We can always take advantage of that. And something happens pretty just shortly after that passage that I read, where there he reflects upon the journey and he realizes, wait, I came over a mountain pass. And if it weren't for that lion, I was in the pitch dark. We would have walked off a ledge. So even in Aslan coming to him and talking to him, he prevented him from making catastrophic decisions or even having an accident. And I think that God does that with us all the time, that he's in his grace and in his mercy. He's protecting us from things that we can't see and that we know nothing about, and that If we're willing, we can participate with him in that, and that we can trust him in those moments. And I don't know where you're at today with your faith. I don't know where you're at with your circumstances. And it could be that you have forgotten who walks alongside you in the dark. But I want to remind you, if you know who Christ is, if you have said yes to his lordship, then you have the opportunity to be reminded about who is with you. And that he's longing to speak with you in the same way that he longed to speak with Shasta. And that the comforting breath and the warmth of his presence is there for you and for me, even in our times of greatest doubt and despair. So if you're hearing this today and that's where you're at, I just pray that you would receive from Christ what he has for you. That you would lean into not knowing, and that you would be able to trust more deeply because you hear him talk and you feel his breath. And God forbid you're in a place where you cannot feel or see or hear. I just pray that God would bring people alongside you to speak into your life, into your circumstances, and that he would make himself real to you in the same way that he revealed himself so gently but powerfully to Shasta. I want to say thanks so much for joining me. I'm really grateful for you taking time out of your day to listen to this podcast. As always, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can find me at bobfaby.com. That's my newly designed website. There you can see that I wrote a book. It's called Not My Jesus. It's about the different ways that people try to orient to making Jesus into their own image. And I pray that you have many, many blessings today. Thanks for listening.